any female sympathizer or agitator. Still, the dizziness does not subside. I'm filled with anxiety and fear and a desperate craving all at once. "What's wrong with her?" Frank asks. His voice sounds distant. "Air," I manage to force out. "It's the air in here." Frank laughs again, that unpleasant cackling sound.
"You think it's bad out here?" he says. "It's paradise compared to the cells."
He seems to take pleasure in this, and it reminds me of a debate I had a few weeks ago with Alex when he was arguing against the usefulness of the cure. I said that without love, there could also be no hate. Without hate, no violence.
"Hate isn't the most dangerous thing," he'd said. "Indifference is."
Alex starts talking. His voice is low and still casual, but there's an undertone of force to it. The kind of voice street peddlers lapse into when they're trying to get you to buy a carton of bruised berries or a broken toy.
"It's okay, I'll give you a deal, no problem, trust me."
"Listen, just let us in for a minute. That's all it'll take,
a minute."
You can tell she's already scared out of her mind. "I had to come all the way out here for this, day off and everything. I was gonna go to the pier, maybe try out some fishing. Point is, if I bring her home and she's not straightened out, well, you know, chances are I'll just have to haul out here again, and I only have a couple days off, and summer's almost over."
"Why all the trouble?"
Frank says, jerking his head in my direction.
"If she's causing problems, there's an easy way to fix her up."
Alex smiles tightly. "Her father, Stephen Jones, commissioner at the labs. He doesn't want to do an early procedure. No trouble, no violence or mess. Looks bad, you know?" It's a bold lie. Frank could easily ask to see my ID card, and then Alex and I are screwed. I'm not sure what the punishment would be for infiltrating the crypts under false pretenses, but it can't be good. Frank appears interested in me for the first time. He looks me up and down like I'm a grapefruit he's evaluating in the supermarket for ripeness. And for a moment, he doesn't say anything. Then, finally, he stands, slipping the gun onto his shoulder.
"Come on," he says. 5 minutes.
As he's fiddling with the keypad, which requires both that he type a code and scan his hand on some kind of fingerprint-matching screen, Alex reaches out and takes my elbow.
"Let's go,"
he says, making his voice gruff, like my little fit has left him impatient. But his touch is gentle, and his hand warm and reassuring. I wish he could keep it there, but after only a second, he lets me go again. I can read a plea loud and clear in his eyes.
"Be strong. We're almost there. Be strong for just a little while longer."
The locks on the door release with a click. Frank leans his shoulder against it, straining, and it slides open just enough for us to squeeze by into the hallway beyond. Alex goes first, then me, then Frank. The passage is so narrow we have to go single file, and it's even darker than the rest of the crypts. But the smell is what really hits me. A horrible, rotting, festering stink. Like the dumpsters by the harbor, the place where all the fish intestines get discarded on the hottest day. Even Alex curses and coughs, covering his nose with his hand. Behind me, I can imagine Frank grinning.
"Ward 6 has its own special perfume," he says.
As we walk, I can hear the barrel of his gun slapping against his thigh. I'm worried I might faint, and I want to reach out and steady myself against the walls, but they are coated with fungus and moisture. On either side of us, bolted metal cell doors appear at intervals, each outfitted with a single grimy window the size of a dinner plate. Through the walls we can hear low moaning, a constant vibration. It's worse, somehow, than the screeches and screams of earlier. This is the sound people make when they've long ago given up hope that anyone is listening. A reflexive sound, meant just to fill the time and the space and the darkness.
I'm going to be sick.
If Alex is correct, my mother is here, behind one of these terrible doors, so close that if I could rearrange the particles and make the stone melt away, I might put my hand out and touch her, closer than I ever thought I would be to her again. I am filled with competing thoughts and desires. My mother cannot be here. I would rather she was dead. I want to see her alive. And filled, too, with that other word pressing itself underneath all my other thoughts. Escape. 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 A possibility too fantastic to contemplate. If my mother had been the one to break out, I would have known. She would have come for me. Ward 6 consists of just the one long hallway. As far as I can tell, there are about 40 doors, 40 separate cells.
This is it, Frank says. The grand tour.
He pounds on one of the very first doors.
Here's your boy Thomas, if you want to say hello.
Then he laughs again, that awful cackling sound. I think about what he said when we first entered the vestibule. He's always here nowadays. Ahead of us, Alex does not respond, but I think I see him shudder. Frank nudges me sharply in the back with the barrel of his gun.
So, what do you think?
Awful, I croak out. My throat feels like it has been encircled with barbed wire. Frank seems pleased.
Better to listen and do as you're told,
he says.
No use ending up like this guy.
We've paused in front of one of the cells. Frank nods toward the tiny window, and I take a hesitant step forward, pressing my face up to the glass. It's so grimy, it's practically opaque. But if I squint, I can just make out a few shapes in the obscurity of the cell. A single bed with a flimsy, dirty mattress. A toilet. A bucket that looks like it might be the human equivalent of a dog's water bowl. At first, I think there's a pile of old rags in the corner, too, until I realize that this thing is the guy, Frank was pointing out. A filthy, crouching heap of skin and bones and crazy, tangled hair. He's motionless. And his skin is so dirty, it blends in with the gray of the stone walls behind him. If it weren't for his eyes rolling continuously back and forth as though he's checking the air for insects, you would never know he was alive. You would never even know he was human. The thought flashes again. I would rather she be dead. Not in this place, anywhere but here. Alex has continued down the hall, and I hear him draw in his breath sharply. I look up. He is standing perfectly still, and the expression on his face makes me afraid. What? I say. For a moment, he doesn't answer. He is staring at something I cannot see, some door presumably farther down the hall. Then he turns to me abruptly, a quick, convulsive shake. Don't, he says, his voice a croak, and the fear surges, overwhelms me. What is it? I ask again. I start down the hall toward him. It seems all of a sudden that he is very far away, and when Frank speaks up behind me, his voice too sounds distant.
That's where she was, he is saying. Number 118. Admin hasn't coughed up the dough to get the walls patched yet, so for now we're just leaving it as is. Not a lot of money around here for improvements.
Alex is watching me. All his control and confidence has vanished. His eyes are blazing with anger, or maybe pain. His mouth is twisted into a grimace. My head feels full of noise. Alex holds up his hand like he's thinking of blocking my progress. Our eyes meet for just a second, and something flashes between us. A warning, or an apology, maybe. And then I'm pushing beyond him into cell 118. In almost every way, it is identical to the cells I've glimpsed through the tiny hallway windows. A rough cement floor, a rust-stained toilet, and a bucket full of water, in which several cockroaches are revolving slowly. A tiny iron bed with a paper-thin mattress, which someone has dragged into the very center of the room. But the walls are covered, crammed with writing. No, not writing. They are covered with a single four-letter word that has been inscribed over and over on every available surface. Love. Looped huge and scratched just barely in the corners, inscribed in graceful script and solid block lettering, chipped, scratched, picked away, as though the walls are slowly melting into poetry. And on the ground, lying curled up against one wall, is a dull silver chain with a charm still attached to it. A ruby-encrusted dagger whose blade has been worn down to a small nub. My father's charm. My mother's necklace. My mother. All this time, during every long second of my life when I believed her dead, she was here, scratching, burrowing, chipping away, encased in the stone walls like a long-buried secret. I feel suddenly as though I am back in my dream, standing on a cliff as the solid ground disintegrates underneath me, transforms into the sand in an hourglass, running away under my feet. I feel the way I do in that moment when I realize that all the ground has vanished and I am standing on a bare blade of air, ready to drop.
It's terrible, you see. Look at what the disease did to her. Who knows how many hours she spent scrabbling along these walls like a rat.
Frank and Alex are standing behind me. Frank's words seem to be muffled by a layer of cloth. I take a step forward into the cell, suddenly fixated on a shaft of light, extending like a long golden finger from a space in the wall that has been chipped clear away. The clouds must have begun to break apart outside. Through the hole, on the other side of the stone fortress, I see the flashing blue of the Presumpscot River, and leaves shifting and tumbling over one another, an avalanche of green and sun and the perfume of wild-growing things. The wilds. So many hours, so many days, looping those same four letters over and over, that strange and terrifying word. The word that confined her here for over 10 years, and ultimately the word that helped her escape. In the lower half of one wall, she has traced the word so many times in such enormous script. Love, each letter the size of a child, and gouged so deeply into the stone that the O has formed a tunnel, and she has gotten out. Chapter 23. Food for the body, milk for your bones, ice for the bleeding, a belly of stones. A folklore blessing. Even after the iron gates clang shut behind us and the crypts recedes in the distance, the feeling of being penned in on all sides doesn't go away. There's still a terrible squeezing pressure in my chest and I have to struggle to suck in full breaths. An ancient prison bus with a wheezing motor carries us away from the border to Deering. From there, Alex and I walk back toward the center of Portland, staying on opposite sides of the sidewalk. Every couple of feet, he swivels his head to look at me, opening and closing his mouth like he's pronouncing a series of inaudible words. I know he's worried about me, and probably waiting for me to break down, but I can't bring myself to meet his eyes or speak to him. I keep my eyes locked straight ahead of me, keep my feet cycling forward. Other than the terrible pain in my chest and stomach, my body feels numb. I can't feel the ground underneath me, or the wind zipping through the trees, skating past my face. Can't feel the warmth of the sun, which has, against all odds, broken through the terrible black clouds, lighting the world up a strange greenish color, as though everything is submerged underwater. When I was little and my mother died, when I thought she'd died, I remember going out for my first ever run and getting hopelessly lost at the end of Congress, a street I'd been playing on my whole life. I turned a corner and found myself in front of the bubble and soap cleaners and had been suddenly unable to remember where I was and whether home was to the left or to the right. Nothing looked the same. Everything looked like a painted replica of itself, fragile and distorted. Like I was caught in a funhouse hall of mirrors reflecting my regular world back to me. That's how I feel now, again, Lost and found and lost again all at once. And now I know somewhere in this world, in the wildness on the other side of the fence, my mother is alive and breathing and sweating and moving and thinking. I wonder if she is thinking about me. And the pain shoots deeper, makes me lose my breath completely, so I have to stop walking and double up, one hand on my stomach. We're still off peninsula, not far from 37 Brooks, where the houses are separated by large tracts of torn-up grass and run-down gardens full of litter. Still, there are people on the streets, including a man I take for a regulator right away. Even now, just before noon, he has a bullhorn swinging from his neck and a wooden baton strapped to one thigh. Alex must see him, too. He stays a couple of feet away from me, scanning the street, trying to appear unconcerned, but he murmurs in my direction. Can you move? I have to fight my way through the pain. It is radiating through my whole body now, throbbing up into my head. I think so, I gasp out. Allie, on your left. Go. I straighten up as much as I can, enough at least to hobble into the alley between two larger buildings. Halfway down the alley, there are a few metal dumpsters, arranged parallel to one another, buzzing with flies. The smell is disgusting, like being back in the crypts, but I sink down between them anyway, grateful for the concealment and the chance to sit. As soon as I'm resting, the throbbing in my head subsides. I tilt my head back against the brick, feel the world swaying, a ship cut loose from its mooring. Alex joins me a few moments later, squatting in front of me, brushing the hair away from my face. It's the first time he's been able to touch me all day. I'm sorry, Lena, he says, and I know he really means it. I thought you'd want to know. 12 years, I say simply. I thought she was dead for 12 years. For a while, we stay there in silence. Alex rubs circles on my shoulders, arms, and knees, anywhere he can reach, really, like he's desperate to maintain physical contact with me. I wish I could close my eyes and be blown into dust and nothingness, feel all my thoughts disperse like dandelion fluff drifting off on the wind, but his hands keep pulling me back into the alley and Portland and a world that has suddenly stopped making sense. She's out there somewhere, breathing, thirsty, eating, walking, swimming. Impossible now to contemplate going on with my life. Impossible to imagine sleeping and lacing up my shoes for a run and helping Carol load the dishes and even lying in the house with Alex when I know that she exists, that she is out there, orbiting as far from me as a distant constellation. Why didn't she come for me? The thought flashes as quickly and clearly as an electrical surge, bringing the pain searing back. I squeeze my eyes shut, drop my head forward, pray for it to pass. But I don't know who to pray to. All at once, I can't remember any words, can't think of anything but being in church when I was little and watching the sun blaze up and then fade away beyond the stained glass windows, watching all that light die, leaving nothing but dull panes of colored glass, tinny and insubstantial looking. Hey, look at me. Opening my eyes takes a tremendous effort. Alex looks hazy, even though he's crouching no more than a foot away from me. You must be hungry, he says gently. Let's get you home, okay? Are you okay to walk? He shuffles back a little, giving me space to stand. No! It comes out more emphatically than I'd intended, and Alex looks startled. You're not okay to walk? A little crease appears between his eyebrows. No! It's a struggle to keep my voice at a normal volume. I mean, I can't go home. At all. Alex sighs and rubs his forehead. We could go over to Brooks for a while, hang out at the house for a bit, and when you feel better... I cut him off. You don't get it. A scream is welling inside of me, a black insect scrabbling in my throat. All I can think is, they knew! They all knew! Carol and Uncle William and maybe even Rachel, and still, they let me believe all along that she was dead. They let me believe she had left me. They let me believe I wasn't worth it. I'm filled suddenly with white, hot anger, ablaze. If I see them, if I go home, I won't be able to stop myself. I'll burn the house down or tear it apart, plank by plank. I want to run away with you, to the wilds, like we talked about. I think Alex will be happy, but instead he just seems tired. He looks away, squinting. Listen, Lena, it's been a really long day. You're exhausted. You're hungry. You're not thinking clearly. I am thinking clearly. I haul myself to my feet so I don't look so helpless. I'm angry at Alex, too, even though I know this isn't his fault. But the fury is whipping around inside of me, undirected, gaining force. I can't stay here, Alex. Not anymore. Not after that. My throat spasms as I swallow back the scream again. They knew, Alex. They knew. And they never told me. He climbs to his feet, too, slowly, like it hurts him.
You don't know that for sure, he says.
I do know, I insist, and it's true. I do know, deep down. I think of my mother bent over me, the floating pale whiteness of her face breaking through my sleep. Her voice, I love you. Remember, they cannot take it. Sung quietly in my ear, the sad little smile dancing on her lips. She knew, too. She must have known they were coming for her and would take her to that terrible place. And only a week later, I sat in a scratchy black dress in front of an empty coffin with a pile of orange peels to suck on, trying to keep back tears, while everyone I believed in built around me a solid, smooth surface of lies. She was sick. This is what the disease does. Suicide. I was the one who was really buried that day. I can't go home, and I won't. I'll go with you. We can make our home in the wilds. Other people do it, don't they? Other people have done it. My mother... I want to say my mother is going to do it, but my voice breaks on the word. Alex is watching me carefully.
Lena, if you leave, really leave, it won't be like it is for me now. You get that, right? You won't be able to go back and forth. You won't be able to come back. Ever. Your number will be invalidated. Everyone will know you're a resistor. Everyone will be looking for you. If anyone found you, if you were ever caught.
Alex doesn't finish his sentence. I don't care, I snap back. I'm no longer able to control my temper. You were the one who suggested it, weren't you? So what? Now that I'm ready to go, you take it back?
I'm just trying to...
I cut Alex off again, rattling on, coasting on the anger, the desire to shred and hurt and tear apart. You're just like everybody else. You're as bad as all the rest of them. Talk, talk, talk. It comes so easily to you. But when it's time to do anything, when it's time to help me...
I'm trying to help you, Alex says sharply. It's a big deal. Do you understand that? It's a huge choice, and you're pissed, and you don't know what you're saying.
He's getting angry, too. The tone of his voice makes something painful run through me, but I can't stop speaking. Destroy, destroy, destroy. I want to break everything. Him, me, us, the whole city, the whole world. Don't treat me like a child, I say.
Then stop acting like one, he fires back.
The second the words are out of his mouth, I can tell he regrets them. He turns partially away, inhales, and then says in a normal tone of voice,
Listen, Lena, I'm really sorry. I know you've had... I mean, with everything that happened today, I can't imagine how you must be feeling.
It's too late. Tears are blurring my vision. I turn away from him and start chipping at the wall with a fingernail. A minuscule portion of brick crumbles away. Watching it tumble to the ground reminds me of my mother and those strange and terrifying walls, and the tears come faster.
If you cared about me, you would take me away,
I say.
If you cared about me at all, you would go right now. I do care about you, Alex says.
You don't!
Now I know I am being childish, but I can't help it.
She didn't either. She didn't care at all.
That's not true.
Why didn't she come for me then?
I'm still turned away from him, pressing a palm against the wall hard, feeling like it too might collapse at any second.
Where is she now? Why didn't she come looking for me?
You know why, he says more firmly. You know what would have happened if she was caught again, if she was caught with you. It would have meant death for both of you. I know he's right, but that doesn't make it any better. I keep going stubbornly, unable to stop myself.
It's not that. She doesn't care, and you don't care. Nobody cares.
I draw my forearm across my face, swiping at my nose.
Lena.
Alex puts a hand on each of my elbows and guides me around to face him. When I refuse to meet his eyes, he tilts my chin upward, forcing me to look at him.
Magdalena,
he repeats, the first time since we met that he has ever used my full name.
Your mother loved you. Do you understand that? She loved you. She still loves you. She wanted you to be safe.
Heat rushes through me. For the first time in my life, I am not afraid of the word. Something seems to yawn open inside of me, to stretch out like a cat trying to soak up the sun, and I'm desperate for him to say it again. His voice is endlessly soft. His eyes are warm and flecked with light, the color of the sun melting like butter through the trees on a warm autumn evening.
And I love you too.
His fingers skate the edge of my jaw, dance briefly over my lips.
You should know that. You have to know that.
That's when it happens. Standing there, in between two disgusting dumpsters in some crappy alley with the whole world crumbling down around me, and hearing Alex say those words, all the fear I have carried with me since I learned to sit, stand, breathe, since I was told that at the very heart of me was something wrong, something rotten and diseased, something to be suppressed. Since I was told that I was always just a heartbeat away from being damaged. All of it vanishes at once. That thing, the heart of hearts of me, the core of my core, stretches and unfurls even further, soaring like a flag, making me feel stronger than I ever have before. I open my mouth and say,
I love you too.
It's strange, but after that moment in the alley, I suddenly understand the meaning of my full name, the reason my mom named me Magdalena in the first place, and the meaning of the old biblical story of Joseph and his abandonment of Mary Magdalene. I understand that he gave her up for a reason. He gave her up so she could be saved, even though it killed him to let her go. He gave her up for love. I think maybe my mother had a sense even when I was born that she would someday have to do the same thing. I guess that's just part of loving people. You have to give things up. Sometimes you even have to give them up. Alex and I talk about all the things I'll be leaving behind to go with him to the wilds. He wants to be absolutely sure that I know what we're getting into. Stopping by Fat Cat's Bakery after closing and buying the day-old bagels and cheddar buns for a dollar each. Sitting out on the piers and watching the gulls shriek and circle overhead. Long runs up by the farms when the dew glistens off every blade of grass as though they're encased in glass. The constant rhythm of the oceans beating under Portland like a heartbeat. The narrow cobblestone streets of the old harbor, shops crowded with bright, pretty clothes I could never afford. Hannah and Grace are my only regrets. The rest of Portland can dissolve into nothing for all I care.
its shiny, spindly false towers and blind storefronts and staring, obedient people bowing their heads to receive more lies, like animals offering themselves up to be slaughtered.
If we go together, it's just you and me.
Alex keeps repeating, as though needing to make sure I understand, as though needing to be sure that I'm sure.
No going back. Ever.
And I say, that's all I want. Just you and me. Always. I mean it, too. I'm not even afraid. Now that I know I'll have him, that we have each other, I feel as though I'll never be afraid of anything ever again. We decide to leave Portland in a week, exactly 9 days before my scheduled procedure. I'm nervous about delaying our departure so long. I'm halfway tempted to make a straight run for the border fence and try to barge my way through in broad daylight, but as usual, Alex calms me down and explains the importance of waiting. In the past few years, he has made the crossing only a handful of times. It's too dangerous to go back and forth more often than that. But in the next week, Alex will cross twice before we make our final escape. An almost suicidal risk, but he convinces me it's necessary. Once he leaves with me and starts missing work and class, he'll be invalidated too, even though technically his identity was never really valid in the first place, since it was created by the Resistance. And once we're both invalidated, we'll be erased from the system. Gone. Blip. It will be as though we never existed. At least we can count on the fact that we won't be pursued into the wilds. There won't be any raiding parties. No one will come looking for us. If they wanted to hunt us down, they'd have to admit that we'd made it out of Portland, that it was possible, that the invalids exist. We'll be nothing more than ghosts, traces, memories, and soon, as the Cureds keep their eyes firmly focused on the future and the long procession of days to march through, we won't even be that. Since Alex won't be able to cross into Portland any longer, we need to bring over as much food as we can, plus clothes for the winter and anything else we can't do without. Invalids in the settlements are pretty good about sharing supplies. Still, autumn and winter in the wilds are always hard. And after years of living in Portland, Alex isn't exactly a master hunter-gatherer. We agree to meet at the house at midnight to continue planning. I'll bring him the first collection of belongings I want to take with me, my photo album, a sheath of notes Hannah and I passed back and forth sophomore year in math class, and whatever food I can smuggle from the storeroom at the Stop and Save. It's almost 3 o'clock by the time Alex and I split up and I head home. The clouds have mostly broken up, and between them the sky is interwoven, a pale blue like faded and tattered silk. The air is warm, but the wind is edged with an autumn smell of cold and smoke. Soon all the lush greens of the landscape will burn away into fierce reds and oranges, and then those, too, will burn away into the stark, black brittleness of winter. And I'll be gone. Out there, somewhere among the skinny, shivering trees encased in snow. But Alex will be with me, and we'll be safe. We'll walk together holding hands and kiss in broad daylight and love each other as much as we want to, and no one will ever try to keep us apart. Despite everything that happened today, I feel calmer than I've ever been, as though the words Alex and I said to each other today have wrapped me up in a protective haze. I haven't been running regularly for over a month. It has been too hot, and until recently, Carol has forbidden it. But as soon as I get home, I call Hannah and ask her to meet me at the tracks, our regular starting point, and she only laughs.
I was about to call and ask you the same thing, she says.
Great minds, I say, her laughter getting lost for a second in the fuzz that blasts through the receiver as a sensor somewhere deep in Portland tunes into our conversation momentarily. The old revolving eye, ever turning, ever vigilant. Anger worms through me for a second, but it disappears quickly. Soon, I'll be off the map completely, and forever. I was hoping to get out of the house without seeing Carol, but she intersects me on my way out the door. As always, she's been in the kitchen, endlessly repeating her cycle of cooking and cleaning.
Where have you been all day? She asks.
With Hannah, I answer automatically.
And you're going out again?
Just for a run. Earlier, I thought if I ever saw her again, I would tear at her face or kill her. But now, looking at her, I feel completely numb. Like she's a painted billboard or a stranger passing on a bus.
Dinner's at 7:30,
she says.
I'd like you to be home to set the table.
I'll be home, I say. It occurs to me that this numbness, this feeling of separation, must be what she and every cured experiences all the time, as though there is a thick, muffling pane of glass between you and everybody else. Hardly anything penetrates. Hardly anything matters. They say the cure is about happiness, but I understand now that it isn't, and it never was. It's about fear. Fear of pain, fear of hurt, fear, fear, fear. A blind animal existence, bumping between walls, shuffling between ever-narrowing hallways, terrified and dull and stupid. For the first time in my life, I actually feel sorry for Carol. I'm only 17 years old, and I already know something she doesn't know. I know that life isn't life if you just float through it. I know that the whole point, the only point, is to find the things that matter, and hold on to them, and fight for them, and refuse to let them go.
Okay.
Carol stands there kind of awkwardly, like she always does when she wants to say something meaningful but can't quite remember how to do it.
2 weeks until your cure,
she says finally. 16 days, I say, but in my head I'm counting 7 days. 7 days until I'm free, and away from all these people and their sliding, superficial lives, brushing past one another, gliding, gliding, gliding from life to death. For them, there's hardly a change between the two.
It's okay to be nervous, she says.
This is the difficult thing she has been trying to say. The words of comfort it has cost her so much effort to remember. Poor Aunt Carol. A life of dishes and dented cans of green beans and days that bleed forever into one another. It occurs to me then how old she looks. Her face is deeply lined and her hair has patches of gray. It's only her eyes that have convinced me she is ageless. Those staring, filmy eyes that all cureds share as though they're always looking off into some vast distance. She must have been pretty when she was young, before she was cured. As tall as my mother, at least, and probably just as thin, and a mental image flashes of two teenage girls, both slender, black parentheses separated by a span of silver ocean, kicking water at each other, laughing. These are the things you do not give up. Oh, I'm not nervous, I tell her. Trust me, I can't wait. Only 7 more days. Chapter 24. What is beauty? Beauty is no more than a trick, a delusion. The influence of excited particles and electrons colliding in your eyes, jostling in your brain like a bunch of overeager school children about to be released on break. Will you let yourself be deluded? Will you let yourself be deceived? On Beauty and Falsehood, The New Philosophy, by Ellen Dorpshire. Hannah's already there when I arrive, leaning up against the chain-link fence that encircles the track, head tilted back and eyes closed against the sun. Her hair is loose and spilling down her back, nearly white in the sun. I pause when I'm 15 feet away from her, wishing I could memorize her exactly like that, hold that precise image in my mind forever. Then she opens her eyes and sees me.
We haven't even started to run yet,
she says, pushing off the fence and making a big show of checking her watch.
And you're already coming in second.
Is that a challenge? I say, closing the last 10 feet between us.
Just a fact,
she says, grinning. Her smile flickers a little as I get closer.
You look different.
I'm tired, I say. It feels strange to greet each other with no hug or anything, even though this is how things have always been between us. How things have always had to be. It feels strange that I've never told her how much she means to me. Long day. You want to talk about it? She squints at me. The summer has made her tan. The sun freckles on her nose bunch up like a constellation of stars collapsing. I really think she might be the most beautiful girl in Portland. Maybe in the whole world. And I feel a sharp pain behind my ribs, thinking of how she'll grow older and forget me. Someday, she'll hardly think of all the time we spent together. When she does, it will seem distant and faintly ridiculous, like the memory of a dream whose details have already started to ebb away. After we run, maybe, I say. The only thing I can think to say. You have to go forward. It's the only way. You have to go forward no matter what happens. This is the universal law.
After you eat dirt, you mean?
She says, bending forward to stretch out her hamstrings. You talk a big game for someone who's been lying on her ass all summer.
You're one to talk.
She tilts her head up to wink at me.
I don't think what you and Alex have been doing really counts as exercise.
Shh! Relax, relax. No one's around. I checked. It all seems so normal, so deliciously, wonderfully normal, that I'm filled from head to toe with a joy that makes me dizzy. The streets are striped with golden sun and shadow, and the air smells like salt and the odor of frying things and faintly seaweed washed up onto the beaches. I want to hold this moment inside of me forever. Keep it safe, like a shadow heart. My old life, my secret. Tag, I say to Hannah, giving her a tap on the shoulder. You're it. And then I'm off, and she's yelping and leaping to catch up, and we're rounding the track and heading down to the piers without hesitating or debating our route. My legs feel strong, steady. The bite I got on the night of the raids has healed well and completely, leaving just a thin red mark along the back of my calf, like a smile. The cool air pumps in and out of my lungs, aching. But it's the good kind of pain. The pain that reminds you how amazing it is to breathe, to ache, to be able to feel it all. Salt stings my eyes and I blink rapidly, not sure whether I'm sweating or crying. It's not the fastest run we've ever been on, but I think it might be one of our best. We keep up the same exact rhythm, running almost shoulder to shoulder, drawing a loop from the old harbor all the way out to Eastern Prom. We're slower than we were at the start of the summer, that's for sure. At about the 3-mile mark, both of us are starting to lag, and by silent agreement, we both cut down the sloping lawn onto the beach, flinging ourselves onto the sand, starting to laugh.
2 minutes, Hannah says, gasping. I just need 2 minutes.
Pathetic, I say, even though I'm just as grateful for the pause.
Right back at you,
she says, lobbing a handful of sand in my direction. Both of us flop onto our backs, arms and legs flung apart like we're about to make snow angels. The sand is surprisingly cool on my skin and a little damp. It must have rained earlier after all, maybe when Alex and I were in the crypts. Thinking again of that tiny cell, and the words drilled straight through the wall, sun revolving through the O as though beamed through a telescope, makes that thing constrict in my chest again. Even now, this second, my mother is out there somewhere, moving, breathing, being. Well, soon I'll be out there too. There are only a few people on the beach, mostly families walking, and one old man plodding slowly by the water, staking his cane into the sand. The sun is sinking farther beyond the clouds, and the bay is a hard gray, just barely tinged with green.
I can't believe in only a few weeks we won't have to worry about curfew anymore,
Hannah says, then swivels her head to look at me.
Less than 3 weeks for you.
16 days, right? Yeah. I don't like to lie to Hannah, so I sit up, wrapping my arms around my knees.
I think, on my first night cured, I'm going to stay out all night, just because I can.
Hannah props herself up on her elbows. We can make a plan to do it together. You and me. There's a pleading note in her voice. I know I should just say, yeah, sure, or that sounds great. I know it would make her feel better. It would make me feel better to pretend that life will go on as usual. But I can't force the words out. Instead, I start blotting bits of sand from my thighs with a thumb. Listen, Hannah, I have to tell you something about the procedure.
What about it?
She squints at me. She's heard some note of seriousness in my voice, and it has worried her. Promise you won't be mad, okay? I won't be able to... I stop myself before I can say I won't be able to leave if you're mad at me. I'm getting ahead of myself. Hannah sits up completely, holding up a hand, forcing a laugh. Huh! Let me guess. You're jumping ship with Alex, making a run for it, going all rogue and invalid on me. She says it jokingly, but there's an edge to her voice. An undercurrent of neediness. She wants me to contradict her. I don't say anything, though. For a minute, we just stare at each other, and all the light and energy drains from her face at once. You're not serious, she says finally. You can't be serious. I have to, Hannah, I tell her quietly. When? She bites her lip and looks away. We decided today. This morning. No, I mean, when? When are you going? I hesitate for only a second. After this morning, I feel like I don't know very much about the world or anything in it. But I do know that Hannah would never, ever betray me. Not now, at least. Not until they stick needles into her brain and pick her apart, tease her into pieces. I realize now that that's what the cure does, after all. It fractures people. Cuts them off from themselves. But by then, by the time they get to her, it will be too late. Friday, I say. A week from now. She breathes out sharply, the air whistling between her teeth. You can't be serious, she repeats. There's nothing for me here, I say. She looks back at me then. Her eyes are enormous, and I can tell I've hurt her. I'm here. Suddenly, the solution comes to me. Simple. Ridiculously simple. I almost laugh out loud. Come with us, I burst out. Hannah scans the beach anxiously, but everyone is dispersed. The old man is plodded on, halfway down the beach by now and out of earshot. I'm serious, Hannah. You could come with us. You'd love it in the wilds. It's incredible. There are whole settlements there. You've been? She cuts in sharply. I blush, realizing I'd never told her about my night with Alex in the wilds. I know she'll see this, too, as a betrayal. I used to tell her everything. Just once, I say, and only for a couple of hours. It's amazing, Hannah. It's not like we imagined it at all, and the crossing, the fact that you can cross at all, so much is different from what we've been told. They've been lying to us, Hannah. I stop, temporarily overwhelmed. Hannah looks down, picking at the seam of her running shorts. We could do it, I say more gently. The three of us, together. For a long time, Hannah doesn't say anything. She looks out at the ocean, squinting. Finally, she shakes her head, an almost imperceptible movement, shooting me a sad smile. I'll miss you, Lena, she says, and my heart sinks. Hannah, I start to say, but she cuts me off. Or maybe I won't miss you. She heaves herself to her feet, slapping the sand off her shorts. That's one of the promises of the cure, right? No pain? Not that kind of pain, anyway. You don't have to go through with it. I scramble to my feet. Come to the wilds. She lets out a hollow laugh. And leave all this behind? She gestures around her. I can tell she's half joking, but only half. In the end, despite all her talk and the underground parties and forbidden music, Hannah doesn't want to give up this life, this place, the only home we've ever known. Of course, she has a life here. Family, a future, a good match. I have nothing. The corners of Hannah's mouth are trembling and she drops her head, kicking at the sand. I want to make her feel better, but can't think of anything to say. There's a frantic aching in my chest. It seems like as we stand there, I'm watching my whole life with Hannah, our entire friendship, fall away. Sleepover parties with forbidden midnight bowls of popcorn. All the times we rehearsed for evaluation day when Hannah would steal a pair of her father's old glasses and bang on her desk with a ruler whenever I got an answer wrong. And we always started choking with laughter halfway through. The time she put a fist hard in Jillian Dawson's face because Jillian said my blood was diseased. Eating ice cream on the pier and dreaming of being paired and living in identical houses, side by side. All of it is being sucked into nothing, like sand getting swept up by a current. You know it's not about you, I say. I have to force the words out, past a lump in my throat. You and Grace are the only people who matter to me here. Nothing else. I break off. Everything else is nothing. I know, she says, but she still won't look at me. They took my mother, Hannah. I wasn't planning to tell her initially. I didn't want to talk about it. But the words rush out. She glances up at me sharply. What are you talking about? I tell her the story of the crypts then. Amazingly, I keep it together. I just tell her about everything in detail. Ward 6 and the escape, the cell, the words. Hannah listens in frozen silence. I've never seen her so still and serious. When I'm finished speaking, Hannah's face is white. She looks exactly like she did when we were little and used to stay up at night, trying to freak each other out by telling ghost stories. In a way, I guess my mother's story is a ghost story. I'm sorry, Lena, she says, her voice barely a whisper. I don't know what else to say. I'm so sorry. I nod, staring out at the ocean. I wonder whether what we learned about the other parts of the world, the uncured parts, is accurate. Whether they're really as wild and ravaged and savage and full of pain as everyone has always said. I'm pretty sure this, too, is a lie. Easier, in many ways, to imagine a place like Portland. A place with its own walls and barriers and half-truths. A place where love still flickers into existence, but imperfectly. You see why I have to leave, I say. It's not really a question, but she nods. Yeah. Hannah gives her shoulders a tiny shake, as though trying to rouse herself from a dream. Then she turns to me. Even though her eyes are sad, she manages a smile. You, Lena Holloway, she says, are a legend. Yeah, right. I roll my eyes, but I feel better. She's called me by my mother's name, so I know she understands. A cautionary tale, maybe? I'm serious. She brushes her hair out of her face, staring at me intently. I was wrong, you know? Remember what I said at the beginning of the summer? I thought you were afraid. I thought you were too scared to take any chances. The sad smile tugs at her lips again. Turns out you're braver than I am. Hannah, that's okay. She waves a hand, cutting me off. You deserve it. You deserve more. I don't really know what to say to that. I want to hug her, but instead I wrap my arms around my waist, squeezing. The wind coming off the water is biting. I'll miss you, Hannah, I say after a minute. She walks a couple of steps toward the water, kicks sand in an arc with the toe of her shoe. It seems to hang in the air for a fraction of a second before scattering. Well, you know where I'll be. I stand there for a while, listening to the tide sucking on the shore, the water heaving and tumbling with bits of rock. Stone whittled to sand over thousands and thousands of years. Someday maybe this will all be water. Someday maybe it will all get sucked into dust. Then Hannah spins around and says, Come on, race you back to the track. And takes off running before I can say okay. No fair, I call after her. But I don't try very hard to catch up. I let her stay a few feet ahead of me and try to memorize her exactly as she is. Running, laughing, tan and happy and beautiful and mine. Blonde hair flashing in the last rays of sun, like a torch. like a beacon of good things to come and better days ahead for us both. Love, the deadliest of all deadly things. It kills you both when you have it and when you don't. But that isn't it exactly. The condemner and the condemned, the executioner, the blade, the last-minute reprieve, the gasping breath and the rolling sky above you, and the thank you, thank you, thank you, God. Love, it will kill you and save you both. Chapter 25. I must be gone and live, or stay and die. From the cautionary tale Romeo and Juliet by William Shakespeare, reprinted in 100 Quotes to Know for the Boards by the Princeton Review. It's cold when I make my way toward 37 Brooks sometime after midnight, and I have to zip my nylon windbreaker up all the way to my chin. The streets are as dark and still as I've ever seen them. There isn't a whisper of movement anywhere. No curtains twitching in windows. No shadows skating across walls and making me jump. No glittering alley cat eyes or scrabbling rat's feet or the distant drumbeat of footsteps on the pavement as the regulators make their rounds. It's as though everyone is already braced for winter, as though the whole city is in the middle of a deep freeze. It's a little freaky, actually. I think again of the house that somehow survived the Blitz and now stands out there in the wilds. Perfectly preserved but totally uninhabited, with wild flowers growing through all its rooms. I'm relieved when I turn the corner and see the rusty iron fence that marks 37 Brooks periphery. Feel a tremendous rush of happiness when I think of Alex squatting in one of the dark rooms, solemnly packing a backpack with blankets and canned food. I haven't realized until now that at some point over the summer I began to think of 37 Brooks as home. I hitch my own backpack a little higher on my shoulder and jog to the gate. But something's wrong with it. I rattle it a few times, but it doesn't open. At first I think it's stuck. Then I notice that someone has looped a padlock through the gate. It looks new, too. It glitters sharply in the moonlight when I tug it. 37 Brooks is locked. I'm so surprised I can't even be frightened or suspicious. My only thought is of Alex and where he is and whether he's responsible for the lock. Maybe I think he locked the property to protect our stuff. Or maybe I'm early or maybe I'm late. I'm just trying to swing myself over the fence when Alex materializes from the darkness to my right, stepping silently out of the shadows. Alex! Though we've only been apart for a few hours, I'm so happy to see him. Soon he'll be mine, openly and totally. I forget to keep my voice down as I rush to him. Shh. He wraps his arms around me as I practically leap on top of him and staggers backward a little. But when I tilt my head up to look at him, he's smiling, and I can tell he's just as happy as I am. He kisses the tip of my nose. We're not safe yet. Yeah, but soon. I stand on my tiptoes and kiss him softly. As always, the pressure of his lips on mine seems to blot out everything bad in the world. I have to wrench myself away from him, slapping his arm playfully as I do. Thanks for giving me a key, by the way.
A key?
Alex squints, confused. For the lock? I try to squeeze him, but he steps away from me, shaking his head, his face suddenly stark white and terrified. And in that second, I get it. We both do. And Alex opens his mouth, but it seems to take forever, and at the exact moment I realize why I can suddenly see him so clearly, framed in light, frozen like a deer caught in the beams of a truck. The regulators are using floodlights tonight. A voice booms out through the night. Freeze! Both of you! Hands on your head! At the same time, Alex's voice finally reaches me. Urgent. Go! Lena, go! He's already backpedaling through the darkness, but it takes my feet longer to move, and by the time I do, running blindly and without aim down the first street I see, the night has come alive with mobile shadows, grabbing at me, shouting, tearing at my hair, hundreds of them, it seems, pouring down the hill, materializing out of the ground, from trees, from air. Get her! Get her! My heart is bursting in my chest and I can't breathe. I've never been so scared. I'll die from fright. More and more shadows turn to people, all of them grabbing, screaming, holding glittering metal weapons, guns and clubs, cans of mace. I duck and spin past rough hands, make a break for the hill that cuts over to Brandon Road, but it's no use. A regulator grabs me roughly from behind. I barely shake off his grasp before I'm pinballing off someone wearing a guard's uniform, feeling another pair of hands snatching at me. The fear is a shadow now, a blanket, smothering me, making it impossible to breathe. A patrol car springs to life beside me, and the revolving lights illuminate everything starkly, but only for a second, and the world around me pulses black, white, moving forward in bursts, in slow motion. A face contorted into a terrible scream, a dog leaping from the left, teeth bared, someone shouting, "Take her down! Take her down!" Can't breathe, can't breathe, can't breathe. A high whistling sound, a scream, a club frozen momentarily in the air. A club falling, a dog jumping, snarling, searing pain straight through me, like heat. Then blackness. When I open my eyes, the world seems to have broken apart into 1,000 pieces. All I see are tiny shards of light, fuzzy and swirling like they've been shaken up by a kaleidoscope. I blink several times, and slowly the shards resolve and rearrange themselves into a bell-shaped light and a cream-colored ceiling, marred by a large water stain in the shape of an owl. My room. Home. I'm home. For a second I feel relieved. My body is prickling like I've been stuck with needles all over my skin, and all I want to do is lie back against the softness of my pillows and sink into the darkness and oblivion of sleep, wait for the sharp pain in my head to dissipate. Then I remember. The lock. The attack. The swarming shadows. And Alex. I don't know what happened to Alex. I flail, trying to sit up, but agonizing pain shoots from my head down to my neck and forces me back against the pillows, gasping. I close my eyes and hear the door to my room scrape open. Voices swell suddenly from downstairs. My aunt is talking to someone in the kitchen, a man whose voice I don't recognize. A regulator, probably. Footsteps cross the room. I keep my eyes squeezed tight, pretending to sleep as someone leans across me. I feel a warm breath tickle the side of my neck. Then more footsteps coming up the stairs and Jenny's voice, a hiss at the door. "What are you doing here? Aunt Carol told you to stay away. Now get downstairs before I tell." The weight eases off the bed, and light footsteps patter away back into the hall. I crack my eyes open, the barest squint, just enough to make out Grace as she ducks around Jenny, who is standing in the doorway. She must have been checking on me. I squeeze my eyes shut again as Jenny takes several tentative steps toward the bed. Then she pivots abruptly, as though she can't leave the room fast enough. I hear her call out, "Still asleep!" The door scrapes closed again, but not before I hear from the kitchen very clearly, "Who was it? Who infected her?" This time I force myself to sit, despite the pain knifing through my head and neck and the terrible sensation of swinging that accompanies every movement I make. I try to stand, but find my legs won't hold me. Instead, I sink to the ground and crawl over to the door. Even